everyone. Welcome to Stutter Talk, episode 491 for January 21st, 2015. This is the Remembering Gerald Siegel episode. I'm Peter Reitzes here in Carrboro, North Carolina, and I'd like to welcome Dr. Walter Manning in Memphis, Tennessee, and Dr. Robert Quiesel in Macomb, Illinois. Hey, guys.
Hi there.
Hi, Peter.
So great to have you all on the show. I'm going to do all of our bios in a second, but all three of us are people who stutter and speech-language pathologists, so that's always nice. So we're going to be remembering Gerald Siegel, who is a very well-respected researcher and therapist, and I honestly didn't know a lot about him until Walt dropped me a note saying, hey, you should really read his book. He just passed away. He's a really neat guy. And so thank you, Walt, and I really enjoyed the book. So Gerald, known as Jerry Siegel, spent his first 21 years in Brooklyn, New York, and graduated from Brooklyn College with his BA in 1954. Just 3 years later, Siegel completed his PhD at the famed University of Iowa. Siegel spent 40 years in academics and more than 30 years at the University of Minnesota's Speech Pathology Department. In 2002, Siegel was awarded the honors of the American Speech Language Hearing Association, sometimes just called ASHA. And in his book, Dr. Siegel wrote how proud he was to receive that award. Dr. Siegel passed away November 17th of 2014 at the age of 82. Today on Stutter Talk, we've remembered Dr. Siegel by discussing his memoir, Reflections on a Career in Communication Disorders. This will be sort of a potluck episode in which we've remembered Gerald Siegel by pulling out some interesting topics that he wrote about and discussing them on air. Siegel was interested in much, including stuttering and language development, and he stated in his memoir that he preferred being a researcher over being a therapist. In addition, Siegel played guitar and sang, was a prolific writer, and loved handball. Siegel shares in his memoir that when he began his studies in 1949, there were fewer than 1,500 members in ASHA. Robert West, the first president of ASHA, was one of Siegel's professors, and Siegel studied with Wendell Johnson, Dean Williams, and Oliver Bloodstein. These are pioneers in stuttering research and speech pathology, and Siegel developed a friendship with perhaps the most famous pioneer in stuttering, Charles Van Riper. Our guests today are Robert Quiesel, who is a person who stutters, a professor emeritus of communication sciences, and a retired board-certified specialist in fluency disorders. Dr. Walt Manning is a person who stutters as well, and a professor in the School of Communication Sciences at the University of Memphis. Dr. Manning is a board-certified specialist in fluency disorders, a fellow of the American Speech-Language Hearing Association, as is Bob Quiesel, and Walt has published more than 100 articles in a variety of professional journals. The third edition of Dr. Manning's textbook, Clinical Decision-Making in Fluency Disorders, was published in 2010. And as I've stated on air before, it is my favorite stuttering textbooks. Guys, let's get rolling on Gerald Siegel. We're going to talk a lot about his memoir today, but Walt, you have had some personal interactions with Gerald Siegel. You wrote something and he contacted you about it. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, a few years ago, I wrote an article for one of the ASHA-related journals and was about the topic of what if you're a clinician, a speech pathologist who doesn't stutter, how can you understand? And the title was, how can you understand? You don't stutter, explanation point. And I've often said that for people who don't stutter, you may get that question sometime, maybe in kind of filled with anger in some cases from some of your clients. How can you possibly understand this situation? You don't stutter. You don't have the lived experience. One of my comments in that article was that I fully believe that people who don't stutter, we could name a whole bunch of them in the field who don't have a history of stuttering, I think really do fully understand the stuttering experience. It actually would be interesting, I think, to do a more informed study to find out how it is these people who don't stutter. I mean, and we can talk about a whole bunch of them, Gene Cooper, Nan Ratner, Scott Yarson. I could go on and on.
Phil Schneider.
Yes, and they seem to fully understand. And one of the things I said in my article, not only by the emphasis they place on various things in therapy, things other than the frequency of stuttering, for example, but also by their research questions that they ask. I happened to send a copy of this before I sent it into the journal to Jerry Siegel. He said he enjoyed it. He said he did kind of bristle, I think was the term he used when he read that comment about, you can tell also by you tell about the person doing the research and by the questions they ask, whether or not they understand the experience of stuttering. And Jerry said, I kind of bristled at that as a behaviorist, but he was okay with that. I've always referred to Jerry, and he enjoyed the title as now I can't think of the term, enlightened behaviorist. Yeah. enlightened behaviorist, where he was, you know, he was willing to take a kind of a postmodern approach and look at the depth of the experience. And I know, Peter, you're probably going to quote some things in the book that relate to that, but he was less concerned with how the person who, or with about the person who stuttered or how they felt about the experience than he was the data he was gathering to try to understand the phenomenon. But I will say also that at the front end here, of all the people I've met in the field, and of course there are some wonderful humanistic people in our field, Jerry was one of the top 5 or 10 people, I guess, I've ever met in the field from a broad perspective. His personality, his humor, his writing ability. He was, even though he was very much of a scientist and trained that way, I think he was also very much of a humanist because he was very involved in his church and his synagogue. And he was, you could tell by his commencement speeches and by the speeches he's given in many cases in Asia with received standing ovations. He was very moving in his descriptions of whatever he was describing, along with, this wonderful humor he was able to show in his writing. Yeah. He was one of the top people I think I've ever met in the field.
Yeah, I keep hearing that from folks, and I should mention that in Siegel's memoir, he actually has several memoirs, so the memoir we're discussing is Academic and Personal Reflections on a Career in Communication Disorders, and a part of the memoir is reprinting graduation speeches. And, I got to that part of the book and I was kind of expecting some of the boring graduation speeches I've heard over the years. And it's anything but the sort. In fact, I kind of would be surprised if he could get away with saying some of the things that he said. But, Bob, do you have any thoughts on what Walt and I have said so far?
No, as I say, I think that I didn't know Jerry nearly as well as Walt did. I think I met Jerry once. I think I met him at the SID4, then SID, now SIG4 leadership conference back in 95, I think it was. And he and I had a chance to interact. And I also was at the Council of Academic Programs meeting where he gave the speech that he also reprinted in this book as well. And again, I think that it's the kind of a thing where when you read people's writing, you often don't get a sense of what they're really like as a person. I've always enjoyed meeting people and talking to them because you get a whole different sense of people and what they're like when you meet them and interact with them. You can only reveal so much of yourself via the way that you write.
Yeah, and let me just share with you all and the listeners two things from the memoir. So on page 50, he's talking about his relationship with a colleague, Martin, who he did research with. And he said, and Siegel said, quote, "It troubled Martin that I cared more about the problem of stuttering than I did about the stutterers who experienced that problem." And I read that and I thought, oh man, I would want my therapist to care more about the therapy than the research. But then on page 102, Siegel writes, "I think that what we," he's referring to speech pathologists, "have to offer becomes tarnished if, in the name of humane service, we ignore the humanity of those we serve." So, I mean, Bob, can you reconcile that at all?
Well, actually, in this book, there are a number of places where I sort of felt like he was saying things in one place, and then I'd read something later in the book, and he would say something that seemed to be almost a polar opposite. And again, I think it might be that he, as a researcher, and I think particularly a researcher coming out of a place like Iowa, where again, you know, you're concerned with your data, with the accuracy of your data. You come out of a PhD program, and it's certainly quite different than what a clinical experience is like. I think that when he was speaking, that first quote, I think, has to do more with the idea that when you're looking for the data is what's really trying to drive the things that you're doing. So you're interested in the data more so than the person that you're gathering the data from. And then later on, when he's talking about, but when you're working with people, you're really talking about more than simply numbers. The clinical interaction is a much fuller experience than simply the kind of numbers you would gather when you're doing a highly controlled experimental study. Mm-hmm.
And I want to bring Walt in just a minute to get into operant conditioning, which Siegel's really known for. But Bob, just real quick, I know that you are a big fan of Dean Williams. We've talked about that on air. And Gerald Siegel studied with Dean Williams. So I want to share with you something from the book, page 72. So Siegel writes, quote, "I did my first therapy when Dean Williams' paper, A Point of View About Stuttering, was about to be published. In clinic sessions, my clients, that is, persons who spoke with a non-fluent dialect, learned to analyze the difference between my tongue got stuck on the roof of my mouth and I pressed my tongue against the roof of my mouth. We took our therapy out of the building and into the streets and stopped strangers to ask directions." You know, and, you know, we've talked about that paper at least a few times on Stutter Talk. And
right.
And so, but I couldn't really tell how much Siegel was embracing this, or, I mean, it's sort of amazing to have been there at that time. What did you think about that section of the memoir?
Well, see, I wasn't quite sure exactly how he felt about his whole time at Iowa, because in the book he talks about that he wanted to go study with Johnson, but Johnson, I believe, had a heart attack. He was ill, and therefore he wasn't able to study with Johnson. And actually, the work he did at Iowa was not really in the area of stuttering. He really, I think, he did work in aphasia, I believe it was, for his PhD. And so I'm not sure if he was sort of angry because he didn't get the doctoral experience he had hoped to get at Iowa or whatever. But I think that there are times when his humor in the book, when he's talking about Wendell Johnson and talking about Iowa, is a little bit pointed and almost a little bit angry. At least that's the way I read it. And I know there are some other things that he says in the book where it's almost like he's mocking the things that were being done at the time he was at Iowa.
Yeah, I got a similar sense. And of course, you're talking about Wendell Johnson, who is considered one of the big pioneers in stuttering and speech pathology. This is Stutter Talk. Peter Reitz is here with Bob Quisel and Walter Manning. We're talking about Gerald Siegel, and we're remembering him by talking about his memoir. Walt, I want to get you in on operant conditioning. Gerald Siegel was known for operant conditioning. I went to the Bloodstein and Ratner Handbook of Stuttering, and they sort of confirm what Siegel wrote in this memoir, that while a psychologist, Gold Diamond, and his colleagues were the first to do studies on operant conditioning and stuttering, that Siegel and his colleagues were the first to bring operant conditioning into speech pathology for people who stutter. Well, could you describe maybe like what he did in operant conditioning or one of his big studies? And, you know, also feel free to comment on anything that Bob and I just mentioned.
Well, let me start with what Bob said. I totally agree with everything Bob said in terms of how that statement about he and Martin. I think the first statement that Bob mentioned, I think it was reflection of Jerry's striving for scientific objectivity and to really pay attention to the data and understand and interpret the data. And the second sentence about humane service, I think, really fits better with how I knew him. And he was, as I said, very much of a humanist and very sensitive and could read other people quite well. I don't think he was, you know, he was more interested in being a researcher than he was a therapist, but I think he had the potential to be a very good therapist. I don't know how much therapy he actually did, but yeah. And the other statement, now I can't remember what it was you're talking about. his influence with of Dean Williams and that. Having gone to Iowa, knows more about the history there, and I think that was a very interesting interpretation of what was likely going through Siegel's mind, because he does say several things later on. I don't know, Peter, if you're going to talk about the fact that he was a very funny writer, but there's a couple things in there that you probably will quote about the diagnostogenic theory.
Yeah, and you guys can feel at any time, you know, I'll just ignore my questions if you want and bring up what you want. You know, I really want to get into the...
I'm not going to ignore your question.
But Bob does, so just ignore... No,
your question about the operant conditioning, that was the zeitgeist of the time when I was going through school.
Okay, but wait, I'm sorry. I'm going to cut you off. I'm sorry. I want to get that into just a second. But here's the thought I was trying to get out with Dean Williams, is that Dean Williams and Bob was the one who brought this to my attention. Although when I was at the University of Iowa studying for several weeks with the Stuttering Foundation, Tony Seelig, I'm not sure how to say her name, gave me a stack of Dean Williams papers. And it was only when Bob Quisel started talking about those papers that I actually took the time to really read them. But, you know, this Dean Williams idea that stuttering isn't something that happens to you. It's not your tongue isn't just getting stuck. You're pushing your tongue. That was so powerful for me as a stutterer and a therapist. So when Gerald Siegel mentioned it, he's like pulling out this diamond from our field. But I didn't get the sense of how much he appreciated it. But he was pulling out it for a reason. So, I mean, but you can respond to that, or you can jump right into operant conditioning, Walt.
Yeah, I'll just make a sentence or one sentence response to that. I think it's so critical that I'm agreeing with you and what Dean Williams was saying. I think once people realize they have a choice and they don't have to cope with stuttering the way they've been coping, often in less than productive ways, and struggle and fight so hard, once they have a choice of how to stutter or even how to speak in a more general sense, I think that you really start to turn the corner, that I'm not so helpless. It's not something that's happening to me, although it certainly feels that way. But once you realize that you don't have to react in the same old automatic reflexive way, and you have some degrees of freedom here in order to play with the stuttering, if you will, and experiment with it and be curious about it and approach it and do it in a different way. Once you realize you have some choices like that, I've had a lot of clients, I'd say, how do you explain the fact that you've done so well in therapy? And they'll say something to the effect, well, I realized I had a choice. I didn't have to be utterly helpless in the midst of a block or avoid some of these words. So I think, I guess I would agree pretty much if I'm interpreting Dean Williams' approach.
And let me also mention, Peter, that, you know, having been at Iowa for about 4 years and having watched Dean Williams do lots of therapy, both live and on videotape, you know, he was great. I mean, it was wonderful to watch him work with somebody and help them to bring that out, like help them to see that they had those choices, that they could do things differently, and to see those light bulbs go off in clients' heads, you know, where they would suddenly realize that, you know, I can do things differently. I can change the way that I talk, and I don't have to feel stuck. And he was really a wonderful person to watch do therapy, and he was a really, really good guy too. So
Yeah, and even with the genetic studies that have come out by Drina and his crew, where, you know, they have found that for many people who stutter, there's this genetic link, you know, it's still the Dean Williams stands up, you know, it's for me, it's about taking responsibility and changing it from it's happening to me to I'm doing something and I can change what I'm doing, you know, with or without the genetics papers involved, you know, so I deeply appreciate what Dean Williams brought to the field. And, you know, again, it just struck me that he would pull out this important nugget that he was there when this happened. And I mean, again, he shared it for a reason, but, you know, he didn't go into it at all. He didn't mention any clients whose lives were changed by this. He didn't mention watching the great Dean Williams work, or he might have. I don't remember. That doesn't stick out to me. But operant conditioning, I mean, am I right to think that Gerald Siegel sort of helped a monumental something in our field by bringing operant conditioning into speech pathology?
Yeah, I think he, you know, that was the time when in the 60s and 70s when the journals were full of behaviorist articles and studies and operant conditioning I think he was one of the first. He and Martin ventured into the into that area along with, and other people were doing it too. Brutton and Onslow and Ryan. There were a bunch of people doing that. But I think his work with some of the initial stuff, as Nan and Oliver had said in their book, I think you had asked me one time how much that had Jerry's work influenced the development of Lidcombe, and I think there was some connection there. Although it's rather indirect, I think it probably had to do with Roger Ingham's postdoctoral work with Martin and Jerry at Minnesota, and then Roger Ingham's interaction at the time with Mark Onslow, who was one of the premier people developing the Lidcombe program particularly for preschool children. So I think his work did have an impact on that and that interaction at Minnesota. You asked me to mention some of their earlier work. I think that Jerry's work kind of helped people move away from the Johnson diagnostogenic theory, the idea that parents overreacted to normal fluency breaks of their young children, and the children then tried to not to do that and started to struggle more and got into the whole primary, secondary stuttering kind of thing. But the idea that Johnson thought that punishment increased stuttering, in other words, where operant conditioning theory held that punishment would reduce a behavior like stuttering. And so that was the thing they got into, and they initially used, there were all kinds of punishments used at that time, shocks and buzzers and saying the word wrong when somebody stuttered. They found that time out from talking, whether it was working with adults or working with younger kids later, was the quote, the punishment they wanted to use. And they found that when they used punishment both with typically fluent adults, and then they ventured, he said, cautiously into this kind of the scary area of punishing younger children, they also found the same thing happened with them when they punished them with a timeout, that it decreased the stuttering. And so it kind of went against the idea that punishment increased stuttering, as they were saying in the diagnostogenic theory for several years. Other people criticized their work at the time that Martin and Siegel were doing, because they felt that it was less humanistic and too mechanistic. And they also people suggested also that, and I think this was correct, and I think Jerry eventually came around to this, that they felt that things like other things were probably causing the decrease in stuttering. That is, a timeout might have been a distraction, or these other things could have been a distraction too, rather than just punishment.
Could I just jump in real quick? At one point, Siegel mentioned, I think by his colleague Martin, that Martin and colleagues did a study, an operant conditioning study, where the words right, wrong, and tree were used.
And, well, yeah, that wasn't their study. That was Gene Cooper's study.
That was Gene.
Yeah. Oh, it was Gene Cooper. But I think it was Siegel who said that, you know, it's really interesting that the word tree reduced stuttering as much as the other words they used. And I think he made the point that perhaps just a word like tree in response to stuttering brought the speaker's attention to how they were talking, to what they were doing. Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting. Again, you know, we often say that in speech therapy, whatever we're doing is drawing attention to how we talk. But I thought that was a neat insight. But I cut you off, Walt.
Yeah, it was just an aspect of highlighting what Cooper and I can't think of the other authors. Maybe Bob can remember the names of the other authors. That just highlighted, and Jerry came around to thinking of this too, that whatever you did would highlight, even if you're counting or you're self-monitoring and you're paying attention to how you're using your speech production system. So if you highlight moments of stuttering, you could, I guess, technically say that's a punishment because it decreases the behavior. There's somewhat kind of circular reasoning here, and seems to me in the operant approach, but it did decrease it. But I think, as Jerry and most people would say now, and of course Gene Cooper also, that it really just highlighted what was going on. But it did. I guess the biggest thing, I noticed, he said their work, finding the opposite of what Johnson and his colleagues had found, weakened the hold of Johnson's theory of stuttering onset and facilitated the development of new programs like Lidcombe and other programs that permitted more direct involvement rather than working with the child's environment or their parents, and more direct therapy in terms of really focusing on moments of stuttering and asking the child to modify them. And that was really a kind of amazing thing. I remember I was early in my career when they started doing that, and they had a hard time selling that in the United States, and particularly England, where they were using other kinds of approaches that didn't highlight stuttering in that manner. So, but it seems to have worked, at least with preschool kids and some others too, of course.
So if I could just highlight a little bit of what you said. So Wendell Johnson had this theory, and perhaps to oversummarize, the theory was that parents were responsible for children stuttering by drawing attention to non-fluencies or disfluencies or stuttering. And then Siegel comes along and is part of this operant conditioning research wave, and he's saying, well, wait, this can't be true, because when we punish stuttering, whatever punishment means, people stutter less, not more. I know that's a big simplification, but Siegel was part of a movement that sort of perhaps corrected speech pathology. Do you guys think that's a fair way to say it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were other factors. I think it may have been that the diagnostogenic theory had run its course, and people doing research with the exact same data Johnson used didn't get the same interpretation from the data that that Johnson's group originally had.
Yeah. Well, and again, the way Siegel writes, and again, I'm not sure what the truth really is, but Siegel acts like Johnson, you know, held onto the diagnostogenic theory, you know, without changing it. You know, he talks about how Johnson got mad at Bludstein because Bludstein wrote something that questioned the diagnostogenic theory. And again, from the things I've heard, and I don't know because I didn't talk to these people directly at the time that these things happened, but my understanding was that Johnson had softened his view of the diagnostogenic theory near the end of his career, because he realized that it didn't make sense, and I think that you know, people realize that, you know, the something as simple as parents reacting to normal non-fluency and that turning a child into a kid who stuttered just really didn't make sense. And I think that Johnson held on to the basic tenets of the diagnostogenic theory, but I think Siegel makes it sound like Johnson just didn't waver at all from that perspective, and I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Well, so I want to encourage the listeners to consider picking up a copy of Siegel's memoir, because there's such an inside baseball look at speech pathology here. I mean, he talks about who was mean to who, you know, who right. didn't like so-and-so, who stopped talking to so-and-so. And we'll get into a little bit of that, but one speech pathologist in stuttering and I were talking about it off air, and she was basically like, oh my, I can't believe he said that, you know? So he does sort of give you, and he says more than most, and maybe that's because he was of that age. I mean, I have grandparents where they just don't care anymore, you know, or maybe he would have always said, but we have to get into a little bit of that, because it is interesting. This is Stutter Talk. Peter Weitz is here with Bob Kweisel and Walt Manning. I want to get into a 1975 graduation speech by Gerald Siegel on accountability. And I'm going to go to you first with this, Bob. And I read this and I thought, oh my goodness, he predicted evidence-based practice. and all the craziness around. I mean, we love evidence-based practice. Of course we need evidence for what we do. It's the stuff around it. I mean, like Walt Manning, you wrote in your textbook about how evidence-based practice is great. We just shouldn't beat each other over the heads with it like it's a club. And, you know, I thought that was great. So, okay, I'm going to read a quote here. 1975, Gerald Siegel. Of late, accountability has found its way into the lexicon of political and professional jargon. In the process, it's been stripped of its meaning and its integrity. It's a pity, because a good word is hard to find. Accountability has become an accusation and a slogan, rather than a healthy call to self-scrutiny. Like so many other slogans, it's deceptively simplistic and misleading. It's fraught with unspoken, unspoken implications that have put us on the defensive, interfered with our fundamental mission to serve, and created confusion. Bob, is he talking about accountability or evidence-based practice here? Or take it where you will.
Well, I think there was a point, and it probably was around that time, you know, and certainly a little bit later, where basically if you said something like, I'm helping my clients, the response was, prove it. You know, and Walt and I, professors in higher education, you know, we are teaching our students about speech pathology and how to be good clinicians. And the response is, prove it. And I think that's the point that we've reached, where we're essentially this idea of having to be accountable is like, well, you have to prove that the things you're saying are in fact true. And I was reading a thing yesterday, actually, on a baseball blog, where they were talking about this whole cybermetrics thing in baseball, where you try to take these things that occur in a sport and you try to turn them into numbers. You try to say, well, let's take all these performance things that are part of baseball and turn them into all these high power numbers. And the point that the writer was making is that sometimes there are things that don't lend themselves to numbers, that don't lend themselves to simply saying, I can tally these things up and therefore I can say this thing is good or bad or not so good. And I think the point that we've reached in our profession is that we become a bunch of bean counters. We simply have to say, well, you know, how do you know that your students are doing well in the program? And what we have programs to do now is they have to post on their websites, well, how many of your students graduate? This is master's programs. How many students graduate? How many pass the practice exam? And how many students that start the program finish the program? And that then becomes the metric of whether you have a good program or not. And the question becomes, well, what does that really tell you about whether it's a good program or not?
You know, it reminds me of when we had Bruce Wampold on Stutter Talk. And, you know, and of course, we're talking to Walt Manning now. And Walt's somebody who I first read about Wampold's work in Walt's work. And I asked him something about evidence-based practice. And Wampold basically said, look, if you're looking for a therapist, there's really only one question. How are your clients doing when they get done therapy? You know, and like, so to me, like, you know, that makes total sense. It's when we get into the bean counting that you're talking about.
But see, even with that, Peter, we have these questions of like, well, what is your metric of success? In other words, if you have a client that comes out of therapy who stutters and hasn't achieved 2%, less than 2% stuttered syllables, they have not achieved success. Because we have to have some metric to define what success is. And we get into these more nebulous things that Walt and I like to consider success, that are harder to measure. Then we get into these issues because it's like, well, I don't think, or people don't think, that if a person who stutters leaves therapy without highly fluent speech, that they have achieved success.
And I want to bring Walt in on that point. So Walt, I'm going to read you another part from this accountability. So 1975, Gerald Siegel writes, or he said in his graduation speech, what counts in accountability is what is countable. In the proper environment, numbers are friendly beasts, and I believe we can live peaceably with them. But numbers are indifferent to what they enumerate. The number five cares not one whit whether it's attached to births or deaths. A child with five articulation errors isn't necessarily five times worse off than a child with only one. I mean, that's 1975. I wish our profession had listened a little more closely. Walt, take it where you will.
I love that quote. I was hoping you'd get to that. I'm sitting here looking at it, and I was smiling like crazy as Bob describing the situation with counting things. Matter of fact, as a professor at a university now, there's more and more of that. Almost every month or every 6 months, you have to justify your existence. And essentially, yeah, they're asking, what have you done for me lately? How many presentations, how many grants, how many books, how many, on and on and on. And you spend so much time justifying your existence. And I guess that's what they mean by accountable. If there are numbers generated, the numbers will be used by somebody in whatever way they would like to use them. And the whole thing is very, very frustrating and makes me look forward to retirement.
Yes.
Accountability, I think, well, it really goes along with what Bruce Von Paul said. Accountability really has to do with not which, and I said this years ago, not which therapy is best. I mean, that's a stupid question in the first place. It shows that a field is in its adolescence, like arguing which car is better, Ford or Chevy or Dodge, back and forth. It depends on the journey. It depends how you want to get there, and the many other factors that are much more important, I think. And what Lompold has said with some of his research, you should look for a clinician. You don't look for a therapy. You find a clinician and you ask him something like, do you like to work with people who stutter? Or do you like to work with children who stutter? And if hopefully they'll say yes, not all clinicians would, of course, but then if they say, yes, I like to work with children who stutter, I guess I would ask them, why do you like to do that? And the quality of their answer, not the length of it necessarily, but the quality of their answer should tell you whether you want your child to work with this person who stutters. I mean, they have to have some passion for it, and they have to have a rationale, not necessarily even a theory, but a rationale for what they're doing and or what they're not doing or when they're doing things. And that's a much more complicated, much more difficult thing to do. And many times doing therapy, you don't know for sure what the next step is going to be, and you have to experiment and get your client being willing to experiment. But you have to have a rationale. So, and this is what Juan Paul talks about too, and others besides him, but it's not so much what you're doing in therapy, it's the meaning, I think, of what you're doing in therapy, and a shared understanding of why you're doing whatever it is, cancellations. But there's more to that than just behavioral changes. It's a much deeper change that they have to appreciate in terms of the meaning of why you're doing what you're doing now in the therapy process. And that is a much more complex question than which therapy is best, whatever that might mean. And yeah, so I agree with what Bob's saying in terms of you have to be careful with these friendly beasts called numbers.
Let me, if you don't mind, I want to share a quote that I found. I don't know who said it, but I love it. It says, the more time you spend in reporting on what you're doing, the less time you have to do anything. Stability is achieved when you spend all your time doing nothing but reporting on the nothing you were doing. And I think that's essentially the point that we've reached.
Wait, it sounds like North Carolina. the paper, you know, moving from New York to North Carolina, I easily do twice, if not three times, the amount of paperwork in North Carolina that I ever did in Brooklyn. I mean, it's unbelievable how much time is not spent doing direct therapy with children. It's sick. I mean, it's sick. As a parent, I want my children with their teachers. I don't want their teacher doing paperwork all day, all the time. It's crazy. So just one more point. I mean, I love Siegel's take on accountability. He was sort of snarky before snarkiness existed. And, you know, he was reminding me of a situation. I've heard supervisors say this, probably verbatim, I've literally heard supervisors say to school-based speech language pathologists, you can only do it, it being treatment, you can only do it if it's in a journal. And that's how over the edge accountability and evidence-based practice has become. And I think Siegel was sort of seeing those predicting the future, predicting the craziness, or just seeing the craziness of his time. I mean, have you guys heard this? I mean, there are speech language pathologist supervisors telling people you can only do it if it's in a journal, and no, there's no mutiny. Nobody says anything.
Yeah, I read clinic reports where they say we did this particular kind of therapy, and then they cite a couple studies in their clinic report, and the studies have nothing to do. I mean, it's just the study that's cited, and nobody's going to look that up and see if it really related. I mean, sometimes it does, but I think that's what's going on. They just have to cite a study to make it look more official and like they know what they're doing.
Well, and again, I think one of the other things he says in that speech, you know, he talks about the idea that when people start talking about accountability, they act like people have not been accountable previously. You know, the idea that when people suddenly decided that, well, you know, you need to be accountable suddenly that just happened. Like people previously were just kind of doing stuff and not really worrying about whether they were making a difference or not, or doing things correctly or not. And again, it's just a basic mistrust of people that you know, like, again, the notion is that SLPs can't be trusted to do a good job. College professors can't be trusted to do a good job. You know, we can't trust anybody. And the only way to make people honest is by making them accountable. And what it really ends up doing is it makes people dishonest, because, again, if you have to follow all these rules and meet all these rules, you basically, you know, the thing I've always said, you know, as somebody who was on CAA and CAA site visitor and a faculty member.
What is the CAA for people?
CAA is the Council on Academic Accreditation for Speech Language Pathology and Audiology. The council that accredits academic programs, graduate programs in communication disorders here in the U.S. And the thing is, between the standards that the Council for Clinical Certification puts out and CA puts out, if people had to meet the letter of those guidelines, there'd be no programs, there'd be no certified SLPs, but people meet the spirit of those. You know, and it's just because we have so many rules and regulations now that you can't possibly do everything that's being asked. So people then become dishonest.
And I love how Siegel, in his memoir, Bob, you alluded to this. He's sort of, I don't know, I don't think he takes both sides of certain issues, but he's fair and he points out things that make you think. So he talks about accountability and he's a little snarky about it. And then he mentions that his university one day asked him to greet a group from the country of India who were visiting from their education ministry. And so one of the big shots from in India asked Siegel what he did. And Siegel said, "I'm a speech pathologist." And the Indian minister said, "Oh, in my country, we not have time to play with children." And I'll be honest, sometimes, you know, you walk into a speech language therapy room and sometimes it feels like playing with children. And I will be the first to say there's language and speech stuff going on underneath. But I think Siegel did point out, you know, yes, we need to be accountable, but we already are being accountable. It's complicated. So I want to share one on this issue of accountability. He delves into an area that I think is very important for right now. I know that Nan Bernstein-Ratner has written a bit on this in her 2005 papers on evidence-based practice. So here's what Siegel writes on page 115. "We have to define the dimensions of accountability in terms of our own professional needs and activities. We must look into our own discipline to specify what we'll interpret as responsible clinical practice, and not leap headlong to embrace models that are inappropriate for a service-oriented profession." Walt, let's go to you first on this one. Do you think Siegel's onto something here?
Yeah, I think what he's talking about is what Juan Paul and his colleagues have talked about in terms of the common factors model. It's not as it does work better in the medical field to have a medical model saying there are specific techniques, there are specific procedures, there are specific doses of medicines that are likely to be more appropriate for that person at this time. But even there, the same medications don't work the same way. Even the precise doses don't work the same way, not even talking about side effects and interactive effects with other medications. And so I think the medical model is a fine one, but it's a little more dynamic, I think, and a little harder to measure, as we've said, some of these things in behavioral therapy. I think the key things we're to be measuring there is what Juan Paul said is, are these people making progress and how do you define that progress? And generally, one way to define it, but the least valid way of defining it, is the frequency of the problem, I think. It's broader and deeper than that, and it gets into things like people around the world have been researching, Ashley Craig in Australia, for example, and the work that Bob and Scott have done in terms of quality of life with the OASIS. It has to do with their agency or their self-efficacy or their resilience in terms of the problem. And thinking in terms of curing stutter, you don't really cure behavior. You don't really cure a way of thinking about yourself, but you can certainly make progress. And there are ways, even though there's a little harder to measure some of these things, it is possible to measure a lot of these kinds of things. And that's what a number of people have been doing in an area of agency and self-efficacy and that kind of thing. And that's, I think, for a healthy individual to function in life, doesn't mean you have to have the absence of the problem, but you can still be very effective. I mean, there's example after example that in all kinds of different areas of people coping in ways that are very, very effective and even maybe makes them stronger or better in some sense than they would have been if they hadn't had those hurdles to jump over. So I think that's a better way to look at progress in therapy in terms of being accountable, like Bob said. How well is your client doing, and how can they measure that in a number of different ways? I think it's certainly possible.
I think, Bob, that Gerald Siegel would have embraced, now I'm predicting, but I think he would have embraced your OASIS assessment that really measures the speaker's experience of stuttering. I mean, I think Siegel really got that counting stuttering was just not enough. What do you think of this topic, Bob?
I think the thing is we want to take these complex things and try to distill them down to some simple number. So we take this complex process of therapy, which involves an interaction of a lot of different factors, maybe over a long period of time. And in order to be accountable, you know, how has your client improved? How have they changed? Well, how do you show that they've changed? Well, you can't take, well, my client has changed, you know, over the last 6 months, their thinking has changed in this way, and this is, you know, these things have all changed. Well, how do you quantify that? Give me a number, you know, is your client gone from a 5 to a 4, you know? And that's the thing that makes it hard is we're dealing with these complex human conditions. And when people want us to account for what we're doing, they want it in a simple, understandable thing. Give me a number. Give me something that I can understand. Don't make me think too hard to understand what you're trying to do here or what you are doing here.
This is Stutter Talk. Peter Wright is here with Bob Kreisel and Walt Manning. We're talking about Gerald M. Siegel. We're remembering him by discussing his memoir, Academic and Personal Reflections on a Career in Communication Disorders. If you go to Stutter Talk episode 491, there'll be a link to Gerald Siegel's memoir in the show notes. So, okay, guys, let's move through some more topics. So in a 1985 graduation speech, Gerald Siegel, he shares a really bizarre episode where, as I remember it, there is somebody of importance who was having a speech and language problem, and Gerald Siegel was asked to visit the person at home to help him to visit this gentleman. And when he got there, there was another leader in speech language pathology there already helping this gentleman. So this other guy was basically pretending to read brain waves. And, you know, and Gerald Siegel, like, I don't know what he said, but he's basically, I can't compete with that. I can't read brainwaves. It was really all bizarre. So he talks about this borrowed prestige where, you know, speech language pathology shouldn't have to borrow prestige from the medical field. We shouldn't have to pretend to read brainwaves to do our job well. And it reminded me of these speech therapists in the schools in Brooklyn who I knew who would wear white lab coats to work as if they were doctors. And it really irked me. It really annoyed me. And people loved it and I hated it. So this era, this spoke to me. Have you guys seen any borrowing of prestige in your journeys in this field? Or should I move on to the next one?
You might want to move on.
You guys don't know what I'm talking about? Okay.
Yeah,
I've seen that. But there's so many stories I could tell, and I would probably end up offending people.
Well,
I know.
Well, then, Bob, tell the most offensive one, please.
Well, no, Larry Moult used to talk about how the AUD students down at Auburn used to wear lab coats, but they'd also wear stethoscopes around their neck because they'd use stethoscopes to listen to hearing aids. So they'd walk around with stethoscopes around their necks.
Wow.
And so they were doctors. And so, but again, you know, that's AUDs. And I know here at Western, when we used to have an audiology program, at one point the audiology clinic director wanted the odd students to wear scrubs in the odd clinic. But again, you know, we often hear that kind of stuff where people are wanting to wear lab coats and things like that. There's this need to look important or look like you're something that you're really not.
All right. I've decided I'm going to carry a scalpel from now on.
I've been on panels where there's some MDs on the panel and you'd go and introduce yourself and you'd come along to you and I say, "Hi, I'm Walt Manning," and we go, then the next guy beside me says, "Oh, I'm Dr. John Smith." Yeah. So wait, yeah. I want to introduce myself again. Say Dr. Walt Manning.
I had a stutter talk guest once who when we got done recording, he was upset with me because I didn't call him doctor enough. Which I always try to be so gracious. So, you know, like, well, I called you doctor half the time. Isn't that enough?
Obviously not.
Yeah, I guess not. So from that same 1985 graduation speech, Bob, I know there was a part that really touched you. So let me read it aloud. This is what Siegel said. "It's not enough to give a student 2,000 hours of clinical experience. More important are those special hours, those quality hours, when students are learning to question, think, hypothesize, and put skepticism to work." And as I hand it over to you, Bob, I'll just say, so often I'll get an email from someone saying, "I need 5 hours in Artic. I need 5 hours in language."
Yeah.
Period. I don't care how I get it. I just need it. Bob, what do you think of that?
Well, again, I think that ties back to the notion that, you know, in order, you know, the way that we sort of decide whether a student is ready to go out and be certified and work, you know, is, well, you have X number of hours that you earn. And there's nothing about the quality of those hours necessarily. It's just, you know, well, you earn your 400 hours and now you're ready to go out and be a speech pathologist. And many of the things that actually are probably more important than actually doing the hands-on therapy, like, you know, the thinking and the researching about the client and understanding what's going on and the problem solving, that's more important, are things that you don't get any credit for. And so again, it's this idea that we take a complex thing and we say, well, the complex thing is hard to measure, so we'll simply measure the time you spend face to face with people in therapy, and that then will become the metric that we'll use to determine whether you've developed in a satisfactory way to be qualified to go out and work as an SLP.
So guys, I think you might have enjoyed, as I did, this really Gerald Siegel shared some dirt in his book, much more so than most people do in our field. So one of the juicy pieces was in page 148. In 2001, Siegel collaborated on a eulogy and a tribute that was to be published to remember a colleague. Much as we're remembering Siegel today, he was remembering another colleague. And Siegel reports, and this is going to be a quote, that Professor Maurice Wingate filed a grievance, end quote, against Siegel's and others. Quote, "The charge was that in eulogizing Martin, we had failed to acknowledge Wingate's considerable contributions to stuttering," end quote. So, I mean, it's sort of like, I've been in this field for not as long as you guys, so I've seen and heard about the craziness, but you read that and you think, really? You wrote a eulogy for somebody and you're being brought up on ethics charges because you didn't cite Wingate enough? I mean, does that strike you guys as absurd beyond belief, or just business as usual in speech pathology? Bob, you're laughing the hardest, so you guys.
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's business as usual in speech pathology, but it's probably as business as usual in the area of stuttering, I would say.
I mean, Walt, did that shock you, or are you just like, yep, seen this before?
Yeah, I've seen things like that before. People are offended because their ego is. I did work in that. I mean, we'd all be offended if you didn't get cited as much as you thought you should necessarily. But I did work in that area, and years ago, when Perkins first came out with that whole thing, I don't know if we're going to get to talking about loss of control or not. But,
sure.
I wrote him, you know, he acted like he discovered that people who stutter experience a feeling of losing control. And I said, a lot of people have talked about that. My mentor, Gene Cooper, had talked about that quite a bit, and I did in a small way, and I still talk about it in my text. But and I wrote him, and I said, how come you didn't cite other people who already talked about this, at least in some small way? And he wrote back and never really answered my question, but he said, would you like to write a chapter in a book I'm preparing? He never, that was his answer, I guess.
So he said, chose sure. Distraction. He's like, it's like you're a 5-year-old kid. Like, look over here at the shiny bright lights.
thank you very much.
Well, you know, I wrote something on voluntary stuttering years ago, like in 2005 or something, and somebody dropped me a note, why didn't you include my work? And I honestly hadn't seen it, and then I went and checked it out, and it was so boring. And voluntary stuttering is such an important, vibrant thing, scary and joyous thing for me. And then you read this totally boring paper on it, and it's like, I don't have the heart to tell somebody that, well, it's not very interesting, and I didn't see any point of bringing it up. So we're laughing now. So maybe if we can bring up some of the funny things that Gerald Siegel wrote, because one of the things I kept hearing from folks is he's a great writer, he's a funny writer, and he truly is. So, you know, one thing he wrote on page 70, quote, my father stuttered occasionally, although I tried very hard to keep it from him because of the diagnosogenic theory. I mean, he's just sort of needling Johnson a bit, or that whole thing, and I thought that was kind of funny. I mean, did you guys laugh out loud as I did?
Yeah, I don't think he was really going out. It's just a funny thing to say, I think. He has a thing about Brussels sprouts later on, and that causes stuttering.
I'll read that, too. From the 1990, yeah, okay. From the 1985 graduation speech, this was laugh out. I did laugh out loud. Quote, mm-hmm. Some theories say that stuttering is genetic. Some say it is psychological. Others that it is organic. But at the University of Minnesota, we think it comes from forcing children to eat Brussels sprouts. We know this because there are several in Indian tribes who don't eat Brussels sprouts, and their children never stutter. Now, for somebody at home who's not laughing, Walt, why is that funny? Can you explain the history of
that's
why
funny
that's
funny? Because Johnson came out with a book. I think it was widely sent out to pediatricians, for example, but it was an article, I guess it was. Bob, you probably know the date. I don't know, but the title was "The Indians Have No Word for It." Well, that's, you say, well, what on earth is that? Well, the word was stuttering. And of course, they early on in the, I guess it must have been in the 30s and 40s, they maybe into the 50s, they had essentially a bunch of white guys go out and sit with Indian tribes and ask them if they had anybody who stuttered like they defined it in Iowa at the time, a hypertonic avoidance reaction, you know, essentially it's very severe stuttering. And I guess from what I understood, they imitated, they showed what that would look like, and they asked these Indians if you people had anybody who did that. You know, I don't know how long they'd lived with these various Indian tribes in the Midwest, but they're, you know, it wasn't particularly good ethnographic study. It's not like they were going to tell this person that, yeah, we have people who do that. And they didn't have a word for it in the sense that they didn't have a written language, but they did, as it turned out with subsequent research, they did have people who stuttered, maybe not at same frequency in other populations, but they had people who stuttered by in most reasonable definitions. But there was this big issue about Indians don't stutter because they don't diagnose it, because they don't have a word for it. So that's where that whole thing came from.
Something else he wrote that made me chuckle. Quote, I worked with a young man who stuttered, but he owned 1,000 acres of rich Red River Valley farmland that was selling at $1,000 an acre. And I couldn't help wondering about the definition of handicap. And I mean, you know, I think we all have talked about things like that. So you have a real good stutter, but you're also very successful in business and life. So, you know, I guess it comes back to the big question, is stuttering disabling? One other thing he wrote that I thought was kind of funny, he wrote, quote, one of my most successful therapy outcomes involved a pulpit priest who had suddenly developed a strangulated voice. I didn't know the term spastic dysphonia. I'm not sure it existed at that time. After one session with me, he dropped out of therapy, gave up his pulpit, and joined an order of silent monks. He was cured. Now, that was so great because I honestly couldn't tell you if it was true or he just was being silly. I mean, did you guys sense that that was a real story or he was just being silly?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one, yeah.
I don't know that he did that in therapy.
Of course, yeah. And again, I think many of his stories, like not telling his father that he stuttered and, I think most of those things were just sort of tongue-in-cheek sorts of things, you know. Mm-hmm. And as I say, you know, I think many of those jokes were just the ones about the diagnostogenic theory and the Indians having a word for it. Those are simply digs, you know, as I say. And that's why I sort of wonder what his feelings were about his whole experience at Iowa, why he felt the need to be so have that sort of mocking humor about where he came from. I just felt that sort of interesting. I was, that'd be something that I sort of wish Jerry was still alive, so I could sort of ask him what the reason for those feelings was.
So, do you guys have time for just one or two more topics?
Sure.
Okay, great. Stutter Talk, Peter writes us here with Bob Kweisel and Walt Manning. Dr. Bob Kweisel, Dr. Walt Manning. We're discussing
right.
Gerald M. Siegel. For those who knew Gerald Siegel, again, we're discussing his memoir. That's how we're remembering him today. So we're discussing things that we pulled out of his memoir about his life in speech pathology that were important to him. So I contacted a bunch of speech pathologists off air, and I kept hearing pretty much the same thing. I didn't always agree with Gerald Siegel, but he was a really great guy. So I just want to read something briefly that Michael Retzinger sent me. He said I could share it on air, and Mike, or Retz as he's known, is a speech pathologist who stutters. So let me share that now. Here's part of what Retz wrote. I was drawn to Dr. Siegel's humor in writing regarding ASHA and the professionals in the area of stuttering. For whatever reason, Siegel was not very fond of Wendell Johnson, although he had Johnson as an instructor at Iowa, I believe. We're not too sure about that, but he might have met Johnson. I called Dr. Siegel a few times regarding his letters to the ASHA leader, every so often with his views regarding the professional state of stuttering, ASHA's lack of care regarding the training of professionals, and the quote, stick it out, and the quote, stick out the chest, end quote, attitude of some professionals who really thought they knew it all. But Dr. Siegel's feelings indicated these professionals were really a bunch of blowhards. So I think Retz was really saying that Dr. Siegel was outspoken and he respected that. And I think it says something that people would read something that Gerald Siegel wrote and they would contact him and call him. And I don't know how much that happens, but it sounds like Retz did that at least a few times. So sounds like he was a pretty special guy.
I think many of us who have been in the profession for a number of years, and certainly Jerry was in the profession a lot longer than I was, but you sort of see the changes that have happened in the profession, and I don't think any of us are really happy about the direction that the profession is going, and certainly those of us that stuttering are not happy at all, and so it's nice to have somebody like Jerry who was willing to send something to ASHA and point those things out, and I'm not sure if the kind of things that he wrote to ASHA would get published nowadays or not.
Right. So. Right. Well, I was wondering that too. And I'll just one other thing. So Retz also wrote, I deeply appreciated him, meaning Gerald Siegel, taking the time to speak with me when I would call him. We had disagreements, but he was a very honorable man and a legendary researcher. And I was really struck by that, where there are so many disagreements in stuttering, but when you're talking about Gerald Siegel, the conversation always seems to end with, but he was a really great guy, I liked talking to him, and that's pretty special. I don't hear that so often, where I really disagree with the guy and I really like him. So let's just do one more topic. We could talk about this memoir and even more importantly, the ideas in it all day. But So Siegel writes about an exchange of letters between him and Perkins in, I think, 1991. So in this exchange of letters between Siegel and Perkins, it's on this topic of loss of control. And you guys can get as deep into the original Perkins study and the Siegel response and then the Perkins response to that. But at one point in the letter, Siegel writes, "Once again, the clinician or researcher is forced to rely on the stutterer's report." Like, it's not a good thing to have to rely on a stutterer's self-report about their experience. And I kind of got the overall impression that Siegel was saying loss of control shouldn't be part of the definition of stuttering, at least not yet. And I know, Bob, you've spent, and probably you too, Walt, both of you guys have spent a good part of your career talking about how so much of stuttering is the loss of control. So Bob, let's go to you first. Like, what did you, I mean, do you kind of see where I was coming at, where it sounded Okay, please.
Well, I mean, I was fairly early in my career when I read that Perkins 1990 article. And to me, it was like that was, you know, Perkins had finally elucidated the essence of stuttering. You know, it made so much sense to me, you know, and again, it was based on the Moore and Perkins article that was a study they had done with a woman who could fake her stuttering. And I'll try to summarize it briefly. She could fake her stuttering. They had her do fake and real stuttering. They noted which were fake and which were real. They played her stutterings for listeners. They were about chance, 50-50, able to identify which were real and which were fake. But then they played her stutterings back for her later. And after about 2 weeks, she was no better than the other listeners at judging which of her stutters were real and which were fake. And what they were saying was, when you take away that internal cue of loss of control that she had at the time she stuttered, but was not there in the audio recordings of her speech, she was no better than anybody else. So that's how Perkins demonstrated that loss of control was a critical aspect of stuttering. And he wrote an article, and again, even though he didn't cite Walt the way he should have in the article, he still I think did a nice job of sort of expressing why loss of control was a critical thing about understanding stuttering and being able to define stuttering. But then, in response to that, Ann Smith, Oliver Bloodstein, and Roger Ingham wrote things in response, saying, but you can't measure loss of control, and therefore you can't do good research because you can't measure it. And then Siegel's letter was about a year later, or at least a bit later, and it was the same sort of a thing. Well, the problem with loss of control is we can't measure it, and therefore it's not valid, and da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. And I think that what happens is people miss, in my view, people miss the point. Just because it's hard to measure doesn't make it not important. And I think that's kind of what that whole back and forth between all these people who Bloodstein stuttered, and he was simply saying that, you know, the word stuttering can mean a lot of different things. But the other people who don't stutter trying to talk about this were saying, well, why would you care about what the person who stutters says? Because they don't know what they're talking about, in essence, you know.
Actually, I know this is an aside, but I didn't know Bloodstein stuttered. I wasn't aware of that. Huh.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that he was a person who stutters. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm going to pass it back to Walt in just a moment, but this reminds me of when I used to teach grad school. At one point, I had heard on a public radio show an interview with one of the engineers for the Beatles. I think his name was Jeff Emmerich. I'm not exactly sure, but when I listened to it, there was so much disfluency, and I was listening to it wondering, does this gentleman stutter? So I used to play a part of it to my graduate classes, and I'd ask them, does he stutter? And literally every time, half the class would raise their hand and say, yes, he stutters. Half the class would say no, and then they'd all kind of say, well, we don't really know. And I'd say, well, how can you figure that out? And they're like, we don't really know. And like, we could, you know, we could give them the stuttering severity instrument or something. They'd literally say that. And I'd say, well, why don't you just ask them? I'm sure he could tell you, you know, but so just to make the point that just hearing the disfluencies wasn't enough. Anyway, Walt, what do you make of this conversation of loss of control?
Well, first of all, I think asking the client is really important to do. People pay attention to all this other data and get hung up on it. And if you have a question, ask the client. And if they trust you and you have a good therapeutic alliance with them, they'll tell you. And there's an awful lot of information there. Yeah, it's maybe biased, but no more biased than our view, I think. I think that loss of control is a core aspect of the experience of stuttering, and probably the one that people who don't stutter are least likely, including clinicians who don't stutter, least likely to understand. They don't realize that why people are doing these inappropriate kinds of things or saying extra words or taking a big breath or tapping their foot. They're doing anything to escape from that feeling of being out of control, and those things get conditioned pretty quickly and very strong relationship to the moment. But I think loss of control is measurable. Last week or 2 weeks ago, I was seeing a guy. You can tell when it's completely out of control with this particular person once you get calibrated to him. And I could ask him questions like, "But that was about 70% control or 80% control." And he'd say, "Yeah, I'd sell it at 75, or he'd tell me, and then I'd guess back. And we could get quite consistent in terms of not just was that real stuttering or almost real stuttering, or were you on the edge of losing control? You can, when you get calibrated to a client and it takes several sessions, you can tell them where they almost stuttered. And mm-hmm. and they say, yeah, I almost lost it there. I was going to switch the word and I went ahead with it. And it was a little sticky and I didn't feel very much in control of it, but I, you know, it sounded fairly fluid. But I think you can measure these things. And I understand Jerry's dilemma in terms of not getting hard numbers on it. But I think you can do that quite quickly. And I think it's important for the client to realize that I almost took charge of that and did it exactly. First of all, I said the word I wanted to say. I didn't avoid. I said that word. I usually have a lot more trouble with it and get really stuck. And it goes on and on and on. That time I was able to pull out of it and I felt really in charge of it. You could use the word control. I don't know if I like the word control. It sounds like you're holding on too hard to this thing and holding on to your fluency maybe too much. But I think you can get a sense of whether you've lost your balance a little bit or lost your balance a lot. One of my doc students recently used the analogy of leaning back on your chair, where you can lean back on the chair and it would fall over if you weren't careful. And that feeling of starting to fall backwards is kind of close, or Bob's analogy that he's used, walking on ice, and where you start to control and you start to slip and you don't know if you're going to fall or not. And so you behave in a strange way as you're walking. And it's a good example of what it's like when you stutter to try not to slip and fall and hurt yourself and this kind of thing. And I think those kinds of things communicate that to people who don't stutter. And I think it's important for fluent clinicians to understand what's going on during the moment, before and during the moment of stuttering.
If you don't mind me jumping in here,
I think one of the critical things that you mentioned there, Walt, that a lot of people who don't stutter don't understand is the notion of almost stuttering. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, I think all of us can understand what almost stuttering is. You know, you're talking along and maybe the word comes out fluently, but you know that was not a truly fluent utterance. Mm. You know, you managed to get it out, but man, that was when I was really working to get at, or the word sort of popped out. It was sort of lucky fluency or whatever you might want to call it. And people who don't stutter don't get that. It's like, well, you're either fluent or you stutter, right? What's this almost stuttering thing you're talking about? And that's a tough one to try to explain to somebody who doesn't stutter.
Yeah, I often find that you know, the stuttering moment is, you know, not a second. It's, you know,
it's
sentences,
right,
or hours or minutes,
right,
or
yeah,
it's this it's an expanded landmass.
Ann Smith, Purdue, talked a lot about that, and she doesn't stutter, but she understands. It's like that great example she's used of studying volcanoes. You can look at what comes out of the volcano, and you can look at the surface features, but you won't understand the dynamics of the situation unless you look at tectonic plate movement and those kinds of things. I thought it was a wonderful example, and that the stuttering moment is not just what you see on the surface, but it could be days ahead of time, knowing you're going to give a talk, but certainly several seconds ahead of time, and maybe lingering somewhat after it if it was a horrible experience where you really were stuck and embarrassed yourself.
And I'm sure we've all had clients who come to us for therapy because they're worried about something that's going to happen months down the road. They come to us and say, mm-hmm. well, I've got to take public speaking in next semester or in two semesters. And they have to come to therapy now to start working on their speech because they need to take public speaking in 4 months or 6 months or 8 months or whatever. So,
well, I mean, to sort of get us back to where we started with this topic of, you know, Walt wrote a paper about speech language pathologists, and maybe I'm going to oversimplify it here, but how much is it important to be a stutterer as a therapist? And when I read this exchange on loss of control, I do have to wonder if Siegel would view things differently if he stuttered himself. And I think he came down on the wrong side of this conversation, but I still deeply respect him. And to some extent, I think you could use his arguments on accountability sort of against his what he wrote to Perkins in some way, but that's getting very meta.
Well, and see again, I think that the notion there is that what I talked about earlier is that, you know, Jerry as a researcher, I think was arguing with Perkins there and saying, well, when you start getting into something like loss of control, it makes research messy, and I'm not sure if he would necessarily feel that way about therapy. But the notion is when you're arguing things in a journal, you've got to argue things from that more scientific, dispassionate, objective perspective. And it's true that something like loss of control is a very difficult thing to measure, and it would make research very, very messy. But it still doesn't make it less important or less critical part of stuttering than counting stutters, certainly.
So I just figured out what this memoir feels like. I don't know if you guys have ever read the memoir Ball 4 by Jim Boughton about being a pitcher in baseball. Uh-huh. This has that feel to it, like the behind the scenes backstage pass. I mean, there's so many things. We don't have time to get into it, but there's so many things he talks about, like, you know, when he first got hired and he wanted to do research, it was too much red tape to have to build to get a research clinic built. So basically they very sneakily built the research lab so the university wouldn't know, because if the university knew, they would have to hire he didn't say unions, but he was basically saying it would have been too much red tape, so we just did it very quietly and we hope the custodians didn't notice. You know, there's like who writes like that? Like, that, you know, that's really cool stuff. But anyway, the memoir is Academic and Personal Reflections on a Career in Communication Disorders by Gerald M. Siegel. We have remembered Dr. Siegel today by discussing this memoir and by pulling out some of what we found interesting in it. There's so much more to talk about. Walter, I hear you.
I started to say something. Yeah. One of the things that is great, one of the things I enjoyed the most, I think, in that memoir was his exchanges with Van Riper, both Van Riper's comments and his comments. And I think as you read through that, I mean, the whole book is you can sense who he is, even if you've never met him, by kind of reading, you know, how he approaches things and how he writes things. I mean, that they say style in writing is the personality escaping onto the page, you know. And I think Jerry's one of the best examples I've heard of that. Obviously, if you've met him, it helps to understand that. But that exchange of Charles Van Riper and Jerry Siegel back and forth, their exchanges over many years, it's really very, 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 very poignant, I thought, and really reveals the character of both of these men who were, you know, very influential in the field, but more than that, really, I thought, really, really neat people.
And I loved how happy and proud Siegel was to know Van Riper. It had a little fanboy to it, like, you know, I can't believe I'm talking to the great Charles Van Riper. It's just great to hear people excited. Yeah. Very genuinely excited. Bob, last word on Gerald M. Siegel and his work.
Well, the thing I would say about the interaction between Van Riper and Siegel is it's two really good writers writing back and forth to each other, and so they both have this really interesting way with words, and that's what made it really, really cool and really interesting was just the way that they could say things.
Well, Walt Manning and Bob Quisel, I want to thank you for joining us today at Stutter Talk to discuss Gerald M. Siegel's memoir, which there will be a link to at stuttertalk.com, episode 491. Thanks, guys.
Well, good luck editing this, and I hope nobody gets upset with us. I know you don't care, Bob, but I...
I'm retired. I don't care anymore. So thank you, Peter. Thanks, Walt.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, guys.